Good evening and welcome to the latest podcast in our series, The Sound of Musicals, a monthly podcast dedicated to specifically to original cast recordings, revival cast recordings, studio cast albums, and film soundtracks, and other musical theater related recordings of all types. We have a very special guest this evening. Leroy Reams is joining us. Hi, Leroy.
Hello. Hello, Michael.
Leroy has been our guest on our separate This Week on Broadway podcast on BroadwayStars.com, but I wanted to get him back and talk to him about cast albums specifically, because I know he has so many wonderful stories, and I'm sure that he's not going to disappoint.
If I do, they never proved a thing.
Now, to start out, Leroy, this to start out with something that I find really interesting, and I think we may have discussed this before, but I forgot, so I'll just ask you again. Mm-hmm. You were in the original cast of Sweet Charity, yes?
Yes.
And you are, in fact, listed on the Internet Broadway database, but for whatever reason, I don't know if it's just an omission, your name is not listed on the cast recording.
Well, that's probably because I was in the ensemble and I did not have a featured vocal part. So probably they did not mention, or did they mention the names of the ensemble people?
They did. And I reread it three times to make sure I didn't miss it. I reread it again. I thought perhaps maybe you had missed this session for some reason.
No, I did the recording, but I'll tell you where the problem probably arose.
Okay.
As soon as the show opened, I handed in my notice.
Ah.
So I left the show very early because I was asked by Julia Prowse to go back and do her nightclub act, which was my very first job in New York, my very first audition, and she paid me three times what they paid me on Broadway. So when she asked me to come back and do her act, I handed in my notice. Whoever pays the most gets me.
That's the part of the story I now recall that you told. So, but you
probably
weren't.
That's why the name has been omitted, because I left very early. I handed in my notice actually opening night.
Right, I see. But you were in fact at the cast album recording.
Yes, I was.
Well, so
it was interesting at that cast recording. The thing that I remember most is as we were recording, they had the microphones above us as we were singing, and what happened, because everybody was basically, they had some singers, but the cast were mostly dancers, and in those days dancers didn't sing as much as the chorus. But, and that, of course, transitioned with that show where dancers began to sing more and singers began to dance more. But they put, a couple tenors, a couple basses, a couple sopranos, and a couple altos to make
right.
the fuller sound. But the rest of us were all basically dancers. But what they found when we started recording, we kind of sang along with whoever sang the loudest. And so they found out during the recording we didn't really know what we were singing. So we kind of did the choreography around the mics as we were moving, because that's who the people we were close to that we would listen to sing. So I know that sounds crazy, but it's how we did the recording. We were like walking around as the choreography to pick up the where we sang with what. And not that some of us did not have trained voices. I certainly studied at the College Conservatory of Music in Cincinnati. But, we basically sang louder with the people who were the singers. So that was a funny way to record the album, but anyway, that's the story.
And that would have been your very first cast album.
Yes, that would have been the very first.
That's an interesting memory. What is your do you have any memories of observing? Of course, by that time, Gwen Verdon was already a veteran of cast recordings
and a very big star, and listed as such because she was as good as it gets. I consider that one of the greatest points of my career, as having worked with Gwen and having her respect. And she asked for me to dance with her a few times after that on television shows, and I was very honored and privileged to have that to my credit. That she liked me and she asked me to dance with her. She was a genius.
And do you remember, do you have any specific memories of her at the cast album session, the way she approached the performance in the studio?
Well, Gwen was a true professional, but she was also very down to earth and very much a part of the company. So, she knew our names. We knew her. We called her Gwen. We did not call her Miss Verdon. And she was very much a part of the company. You know, she came out of the chorus, so she had a great respect for people who were in it. And she was a member of the company. She was very good that way.
Well, okay, so Leroy does not have any solo singing on that album, but
no.
But since you are on it, I'm going to play for our listeners one of my favorite tracks from the album, which is the Rhythm of Life number.
Yes.
Flip your wings and fly to daddy, fly, fly, fly to daddy. Take a dive and swim to daddy. Take a dive and swim to daddy. Take a dive and swim to daddy. Swim, swim. Tingle in your feet, rhythm in your bedroom, rhythm in the street. Yes, the rhythm of life is a powerful beat, and the rhythm of life is a powerful beat. Put a tingle in your fingers and a tingle in your feet. Rhythm in your bedroom, rhythm in the street. Yes, the rhythm of life.
Leroy, you were also in the film of Sweet Charity.
Yes.
Did you, I know that sometimes in the cases of films that the people, especially the ensemble, are not necessarily the voices that we hear. Did you record the soundtrack?
Yes. Yes, we did record the soundtrack.
Oh, okay. Great. Great.
Yeah, we sang on the recording. And as a matter of fact, at that recording, Ben Vereen, Buddy Vest, and I were sort of like unofficial assistants to Bob, as were some of the girls, you know, who were with the original company. Ben wasn't with the original company. I think he did Las Vegas, but he was brought in for the film. And so at that recording session, especially to set tempos, Bob brought us in so that the pre-records, that everything was at the right tempo. And I remember this during that recording, there was a portion in the Rich Man's Fugue where the drums weren't right. And I made a frown. He said, "Why did you frown?" I said, "Well, the drums aren't right." He said, "Stop, stop, stop." I said, "Leroy, go over and tell the drummer what it's supposed to be." So I went over and I went, "Do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do." So that's the way the drums have to go. So it was really kind of marvelous that Bob trusted us, and also that he was such a perfectionist. And because he had, of course, great respect for dancers. And it's what eventually got him an Academy Award. His second film, you know, was a cabaret, and he got an Academy Award. So, again, another genius.
That is a great story. So, knowing that, let's play a little bit of the soundtrack recording of The Rhythm of Life with Sammy Davis Jr. as the soloist, and Leroy and Bud Vest and all those wonderful people. Ben Vereen, yes?
Yes, and we were featured in that number, by the way.
Yes. Oh, right. That's right.
We were like Sammy's assistants, so to speak.
Yes, the religious acolytes of Big Daddy, yeah. Big Daddy Brubeck.
And what's interesting, when we were picking out our costumes, Gwen went with us, and we went into the wardrobe of Universal, and we were looking around at everything, picking out the clothes we were going to wear. You know, just the people who worked privately with Bob and Gwen. So we went into the racks, and she said, "Oh, look at this." And I found a red velvet shirt and paisley pants and desert boots, and there was a big fur, like a Sonny Bono jacket. She said, "Oh, Leroy, put that on. So I said, "Oh, I know what to do. I'll be an Indian." So I got a beard, and I got the long black-haired wig that they gave me, Elizabeth Taylor had worn in Cleopatra. So I said, "Oh, gosh, I'm a Liz Taylor wig, I'll wear that." So I had long black hair like Elizabeth Taylor, and then they put a band around my head with a feather in the back. So that was my costume, but anyway.
Well, it's a great
when
number.
When people watch the film and they see that number, then look for the person in the red jacket with a black beard and hair, and that's me.
It's a great number for the costumes and the singing and especially the incredible choreography.
Yes.
So you should definitely check it out on video, but here is a little bit of the audio of the soundtrack recording of The Rhythm of Life from Sweet Charity.
Oh,
Daddy spread the gospel in Milwaukee, took his walkie-talkie to Rocky Ridge.
Blew his way to Canton, then to Scranton, till he landed under the Manhattan Bridge.
Daddy was a new sensation, got himself a congregation, built up quite an operation down below.
With a pie-eyed piper blowing, while the musket tail was flowing, all the cats were go-go-going
down below.
Daddy was a new sensation.
Flip your wings and fly to Daddy. Flip your wings and fly to Daddy. Flip your wings and fly to Daddy. Fly, fly, fly to Daddy. Take a dive and swim to Daddy. Take a dive and swim to Daddy. Take a dive and swim to Daddy.
Swim, swim, swim to Daddy.
Hit the floor and crawl to Daddy.
Hit the floor and crawl to Daddy.
I'd like to continue chronologically just for organization's sake. Leroy, unfortunately, there is not a cast album of the production of Oklahoma.
Yes.
that you did at what was then
Lincoln
called the New York State Theater, mm-hmm. as part of the Music Theater of Lincoln Center, run by Richard Rodgers.
Yes, he was the producer.
And
they didn't do a cast album. They did of some of the other versions of the shows that he did. I think they made one of Annie Get Your Gun that he produced there with Ethel Merman.
Right.
And I think they did the Showboat recording. And I don't know.
Quite a few. Kismet. With
I think we were the only one that they didn't do a recording of, for whatever reason.
There was one, at least one other West Side Story.
And we were also the last production that was done under Richard Rodgers, so we were the last. So maybe they, that was the end of the series.
Yeah, I mean, it is kind of puzzling because I know one reason that they did make recordings of so many of them was that they were the first really modern stereo recordings of a lot of those scores.
Yes, yes.
So,
and we also didn't have a big star like Ethel Merman or someone like that, which would help promote the album. I mean, not saying that, we all weren't good. I'm not inferring that. But, Bruce Yarnell, Lee Beery, myself, April Shawn, and Margaret Hamilton, who played Aunt Ella. And I guess as far as names were concerned, Margaret Hamilton was the biggest name because of Wizard of Oz.
Yes, well, fortunately, although we do not have a cast album, I think just recently has resurfaced a wonderful video clip of Leroy and Cass doing the Kansas City number on the Lincoln Center Plaza.
Yes, and Margaret Hamilton was also there and did part of the number. So it's lovely to have that recorded, too. There's a story that goes with that. It was done for a children's television program, and it was in black and white. And that's before we had videotape and all the wonderful things we have now. Mm. So I asked the producer of the series if I could have a copy of the number, and he gave it to me on film. And I was told that I should leave that film with my agent at the time, that it would be more important, so I didn't keep it myself. And the agent, unfortunately, when he disbanded, the people who worked in his office threw it out, so I didn't have it. I was so upset about it because it meant a great part of my life and a happy, happy time, and because Richard Rodgers personally selected me, and that, I have that to my credit, and my audition for him was so incredible, and I thought, I'll never be able to have that. And so I kept searching for it and searching for it. And Jane Klain, who's with the Paley Center, as she always said, she's like a dog with a bone. She'll keep on, and she kept going and going. She finally located it to the Library of Congress. But they wouldn't give me a copy of it, but they would give the Rodgers Hammerstein office. So I called Ted Chapin, who did it, and he got the copy. So that's how it resurfaced, and so we now have that. And you can actually see it on YouTube. If you look up Leroy Reams, Kansas City, Oklahoma, the Lincoln Center, you'll see that it's there. So, and I'm thrilled to have that.
Which I just did. which I just did before I called you. So we will put in the show notes for this podcast, we will put a link to it and you can find it. It's really wonderful. You do get to see just a little of Margaret Hamilton at the beginning. Mm-hmm. I think she has a line or two before the number starts. And
yes.
then it's in black and white, but it's quite good quality. So it's just a wonderful little time capsule of something that maybe we thought was lost and now is found again.
And she was a marvelous, marvelous woman. She was so kind to everybody, and she used to invite me down to her apartment at Gramercy Park to have what she called toasted cheese sandwiches and tea. So I used to go down and sit with her in her apartment and yak, and she was a wonderful friend and a great lady and a fine, fine actress. And, you know, my goodness, The Wizard of Oz. We all love Margaret Hamilton.
Well, I've never heard anything but glowing reports about what a wonderful person she was. And, of course, it is so ironic because she was the embodiment
of
evil.
And very sweet, a very sweet, kind lady.
Yes, yes. I, of course, remember her from, as you do, from all those commercials she did in the 60s. What, no, was it Bounty Paper Towels?
I can't remember.
Not that I think it may have been. It was something like that, but she was wonderful. All right, so moving on to Applause.
Yes.
1970, Leroy created the role of Dwayne, which was the really sort of the Thelma Ritter role from All About Eve, mm-hmm. Margot's confidant and dresser. And,
it was kind of, you know, the first, because it's the first time a gay character was written as a gay character, because usually in musicals it was inferred, but not always as. And during that season, of course, René Auberjonois was also in Coco. And he certainly was a gay character, too, but not as outed as the one in Applause. So I kind of get the credit for being the first openly gay character in a musical. But René certainly, you know, joins that category. And I think they opened before we did, but it was quite something in its day. And I was a replacement. I wasn't originally cast. I came in during rehearsals in New York before they went out of town. They replaced Garrett Lewis, who had the role originally, and I replaced him during rehearsal. And so I didn't get the advantage of having been there while Ron created a lot of the stuff. And, of course, he said, well, I'll put more dancing in for you when we get out of town because, you know, and this and that. Of course, he never did because, obviously, the focus went to other things and I was doing my job, so it didn't need it. So, you know, but the wonderful thing that happened with that part was that it gave me friendships for the rest of my life, mainly being the one of Lauren Bacall, which I treasure, and Len Cariou, Bonnie Franklin, Penny Fuller. We remained friends, and it's wonderful.
And with that, let's listen to She's No Longer a Gypsy.
Yes.
From the...
Now, it's interesting that the character that Bonnie played, which was named for her, did the title song, which had, she had nothing to do with the plot as a character. She came out and did Applause, which is the title song of the show, and then in the second act she reappears and Joe Allen's and I'm there and we suddenly are fast friends and we do this number together. It has nothing to do with the plot whatsoever.
As you may have seen just very recently, or actually yesterday as we're recording this podcast, there was a wonderful article on Joe Allen in the New York Times.
Mm-hmm, yes.
And with a picture of Barbara Sharma, who was in the original cast of Sweet Charity.
And as a matter of fact, the role that Bonnie did in Applause was called the Barbara Sharma role, but she didn't get it. Bonnie Franklin did. So, you know, all these interesting anecdotes.
I know that the Applause number is actually set at Joe Allen. She's No Longer a Gypsy also?
Yes, yes.
I see.
We go back to that scene for whatever it was that Eve goes there or something, and then, you know, we do this takeoff on, you know, Eve becoming a star and all this and that. So it really had nothing to do with the plot, but it was a musical number, and I adored Bonnie, and we had a good time doing it. And I got to put in a lot of my personality in She's No Longer a Gypsy because I did a little bit of Mae West, and I sang in my soprano voice a couple of times. So, you know, I did have an effect on what happened with that number. But outside of the disco number, which I did with Lauren Bacall, that was all set. And I wasn't there for that. I just had to fit into it. But anyway.
Yes. Well, I did not, unfortunately, see the show, but I got the album as soon as it came out. And I always loved She's No Longer a Gypsy. It's
yes.
it's really a great number. So let's listen to a little bit of that.
She's no longer a gypsy. She'll be leaving us soon. She did the understudy to the rescue bit. Now she's halfway to the moon. She's no longer a gypsy. No more equity calls. She's gonna get them crazy invitations now to Truman Capote's balls. Have a beer, your last one, dear. From this night on, it's all champagne.
The star was late, and I was great.
You got up early and pulled a Shirley MacLaine.
I'm no longer a gypsy. Put me on the marquee. It's out of the chorus into heaven time.
It should only happen, God, let it happen to me. She's no longer a gypsy. She'll be leaving the street. Hey, she's a regular Mitzi gainer now. Don't you love them dancing feet?
Okay, so moving forward chronologically, I believe we come to Lorelei.
Yes.
Which is interesting in many respects, including the fact that there were actually two cast albums.
Yes.
One was done when the show was on the road pre-Broadway, correct?
Yes.
And then another one was made later. But the good news is that all material from both is now on one CD on the Decca label. So you
really?
Don't have, yeah,
did,
oh yeah,
did
yeah.
Did they put Kiss Apart on that one? Because Kiss Apart we did on the first album, and then it was taken off to make room for Carol's Men, which was a number that was put in out of town to close the first act.
Let's see. Yes, Just a Kiss Apart is in fact on it.
Oh, wow. How interesting.
As is, let's see, Lorelei.
Lee? Oh, wow.
Yeah, and there's the other... there's a few tracks that are marked.
I Won't Let You Get Away. Is that on there too with Tamara and Myself?
Yes.
Right. Well, how about that?
And Paris, that Paris. Exists.
Yeah.
Paris, Paris.
Mm-hmm.
Fans of Lorelei or people who'd like to learn about Lorelei, you don't have to go hunting for two albums. It's all on one CD.
Terrific.
And maybe you could talk about that show a little bit.
Well, we did a year's tour before we opened on Broadway. So it was fascinating to go out and tour a show for a year and then come back to Broadway. But during that period, you know, there were constant changes in the show because, you know, it started out fine and then they started playing with it. And we went through four directors and four choreographers before we reached New York. So I think it lost some of its focus during all of that, but it was what it was. And it certainly was an entertaining show. And it basically, you know, was based on Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. So it's very much just a rehash of that show. But there were changes done to it. And, of course, Carol Channing, you know, gave an iconic performance as Lorelei Lee. So for that reason, it was good to see the show again, because that's the role that made her a star.
Yes, and by the way, before I forget, just to step back a minute, are you aware that on the Sweet Charity original cast recording, that for the most recent CD release, they restored all of the nightclub sequence music?
Hmm. On the
original LP, there was only one section of it.
Mm-hmm.
The Frug, I think, the Rich Man's Frug.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, but apparently they recorded the other parts of the dance.
Oh,
and they,
interesting.
Yes, and so they are now there. It's really great when that happens. There have been a few cases of that where things are discovered in the vaults and there just wasn't room, you know,
mm-hmm,
on an LP. But with CDs, you know, you can fit 80 minutes. And mm-hmm. so all of this wonderful stuff that was not, it just wasn't space for it.
Cy Coleman was a great Broadway composer and it's nice to have, you know, all of his music on an album, which, you know, to me, that makes it much better. So,
Oh, absolutely. And all of that is in the movie of Sweet Charity. But mm-hmm. but it's nice to hear the original recording with the original orchestrations.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And Dorothy Fields was such a wonderful lyricist. And I mean, not that there's, you know, any lyrics in that particular number, but she always had a philosophy that I thought was so good. She told me, she said, you know, I always have an agreement with a choreographer that not to have any choreography until the lyrics are introduced. Because when they sing and dance and do everything at the same time, you don't listen to the words. Where if you set the song up, you pay more attention to it, then you can dance. And of course, a great example of that is Hey Big Spender. Because the girls come out and then they turn front, they're frozen, and they sing the whole first chorus without choreography. And so you really do pay attention. It was a good lesson. I hope that, you know, I can pass that on to whoever is listening, you know, especially for the lyricists who don't get the benefit of getting their songs remembered because there's too much distraction.
Right, right. Yeah. One other thing about Lorelei is that in the cast was Peter Palmer, who was, of course, the lead in Lil Abner on stage and on screen, but didn't do a lot of other Broadway shows. What are your memories of Peter Palmer, Leroy?
Well, a very nice man, very easy and lovely to work with. Had a beautiful wife, Aniko, who was also in the show. She's no longer with us, but Peter is. He is happily entrenched in Florida. And I haven't seen him in years, but when I play down in that area, I get close enough to him, I will get together. And he had a beautiful singing voice and was very much the professional. He never missed shows. And we were on tour for a year, which was a great way to do a Broadway show because you got employment for a year. So if it wasn't that successful, you still had a long-term employment for it. So,
right.
In fact, that happened with two shows with Carol Channing for me, Hello, Dolly, and Lorelei, where we went out on tour for a year before we played New York.
Oh, right. Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, he really just had a really beautiful voice. And
Yes, Peter had a wonderful voice, yeah. You know, it's interesting that Julie Stein, when I was cast in the show, and I got the part, and I was at the theater one night, and this person poked me from behind, I turned around, it was Julie Stein, because we didn't know each other. And he said, hi, kid. Julie Stein said, Mr. Stein, nice to meet you. She said, oh, was that your audition? I said, yes, sir. But, of course, in those days, we auditioned in theaters, and the people sat out in the audience, so we didn't have that personal contact with them. And he said, I was really impressed with you. And he said, I'm giving you this great song that I wrote for Fred Astaire for the movies. And it's called I Won't Let You Get Away or Baby, I Need You. And he said, oh, hell, I don't remember what it's called, but it's a good song. You'll love it. So anyway, and that was, I Won't Let You Get Away. So that was the song he wrote for Fred Astaire that they put in the show. And then Kiss Apart was from the original production of Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. And then Lorelei Lee was written out of town. So I had a lot of the newer material that was in the show rather than retreads of what was in the original Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. So I had that to my credit. Unfortunately, those songs were never as popular as Diamonds or A Girl's Best Friend or, you know, Just a Little Girl from Little Rock. So.
Still, Julie Stein.
Yeah, I adored Julie Stein. He was just one of the great characters and so talented. That man could write a song a minute if he had to. The music just flowed out of him. And he was so much fun to be around. I truly, truly loved him.
Well, thank you for that intro to the song, because let's listen to a little bit of I Won't Let You Get Away from Lorelei featuring Leroy Reams.
I was brought up to be proper and prim, to stick to my class and the blue laws. But since I met you, I've discovered my body, and it's starting to follow some new laws. And as my feelings for you grow intenser and intenser, my dreams would never get by the Philadelphia censor. I see you walking beside me and lying beside me and waking beside me each day. These visions overexcite me, so face it, don't fight me. I won't let you get away. I see us sharing our dinner and sharing our...
I'm so sorry we never made another recording of a Hello Dolly, but at that time, it was a revival, and they just didn't do that because they had the original cast album to sell. But it would have been nice to have had that on record. But when we did the 94 version of Hello Dolly, which I directed, they did do a cast album of that out of town. So, but I never got recorded, and it was, I mean, interesting stories for nothing else, Michael, for us, that when we did that revival of Hello Dolly in 78, Jerry Herman, when we did our first run-through in a studio, and we got to where I sang, out there, there's a word. Jerry jumped up and he said, "Oh, my God, that's the voice I heard in my head." He said, "I never have heard it like that before." So he loved that. And then when we did Kiss, It Only Takes a Moment, and Flo and I finished the song, he stood up and he had tears streaming down his face. And he said, "Those are the two voices that I've heard in my head all these years. Those are the two voices I write for." So it was just a wonderful, wonderful compliment. And then when we did the concert with Flo, that turned into an album that Karen Morrow had replaced Flo doing, that was the reason for doing all of that.
Well, I am sorry there is no album of the 78 production, because I very, very clearly remember that exact moment of you singing "Out There, There's a World Outside of Yonkers." It was absolutely thrilling. It was right in the absolute most phenomenal part of your voice. It was so thrilling, and I've never before and never again heard it sung so brilliantly.
Well, my Ethel Merman impression.
But 42nd Street,
yes,
was a really big deal for Leroy and everyone concerned. The original production, the original Broadway production. I should ask you. Just recently, I saw Leroy and heard Leroy in a show at Feinstein's 54 Below, a Scott Siegel show called Broadway's Greatest Songs. And you related how for the audition you sang "I Only Have Eyes for You," correct?
Yes.
But that did not wind up being in that original production of 42nd Street.
No, and I wanted that song put in the show so badly. When they were looking for a number for Wanda out of town, I came up with this brilliant idea that I said, when he says, "You're going out there, youngster, you've got to come back a star." I said, then the music starts, and then I come out, and this big, the logo on the album, of course, is this lady. It's called, Pretty Lady. That was the name of the show within the show. And I said, so a scrim comes down, which they had in the show, and I said, and I come out as if I'm singing to a billboard. Then behind it, this Art Deco cone opens up, and it's Wanda, and, and she's that pretty lady. That's the show thing. And then I come and I sing, "I Only Have Eyes for You," and then the boys come out, we do a big number, and we have her dance, because there wasn't a lot of balletic-style dancing in the show. And that would have been nice to have had another ballad. And Gower said, "It's very Gene Kelly, and I hate it," so that was the end of that. And so we never got to do it. But they, at one point, when the Dolores Gray came in, they replaced "I Know Now" with "I Only Have Eyes for You." So I got to actually sing the reprise of it that's done in that sequence where they go from her bedroom into the bar into the show with that same song. Three versions of it as the scene continues on. So I actually got to sing a little bit of it in the show. But then when they did the last revival with Christine Ebersole, of course, they restored it into that position. And they took out I Know Now and actually made it "I Only Have Eyes for You." And Christine won a Tony for it. So not a bad idea. But unfortunately, I wasn't singing it.
I guess maybe I read that at one point, but I had forgotten that I didn't remember that it was in the original later in the run.
Yeah, later in the run. When Dolores Gray went in, I think they changed it because she was such an incredible singer. I mean, that was one of the great voices of the theater, Dolores Gray.
Now, one thing that's fairly legendary among cast album aficionados in regard to the original cast recording of 42nd Street, and I'm not sure if you were involved in this at all directly, but there was the famous story about how David Merrick, insisted that he wanted the tap sounds in the opening number to be very, very loud. And, and that he and Thomas Z. Shepard, the legendary cast album producer, fought bitterly over this.
Yes. We almost didn't do the album. Merrick came down and said, "Take your things and go home." So we're not doing it because he had a conflict. And then they came down from the record company and said, you're on salary for us. You're not working for Mr. Merrick today. So Carol Cook said, who's ever paying the bill, I'm staying.
It's
true. It was a big to-do at the recording. The recording was almost stopped. David wanted us to go home. So then what they did to pacify David, they took out the orchestration and just had it done with a piano.
Yes.
So then it was just the tap dancing with just the piano. And then he was satisfied because then he could hear the taps. Because the contention was he couldn't hear the taps. The orchestra was drowning out the tap sounds. So
right.
That's what they compensated on, and we went ahead and finished the recording.
How interesting. Well, I'm going to play a little bit of that, and our listeners can judge if they think that David Merrick was right or not.
Mm-hmm.
So here is a little bit of the opening dance tap dance sequence from 42nd Street. Okay, so that was the opening of 42nd Street. Leroy, you have some stories to share about the show and or the recording.
Well, the score is so great because every song in that show is golden. I mean, it was from that great film, and every song we knew. I grew up in dancing school knowing all of those songs, so getting a chance to realize that on stage was a big thrill, especially in the Dames number. Because, you know, I remember Dick Powell belting out in his tenor voice, so you know. And we put it in higher key so that we would have that sound, the tenor sound in the show, because there were a lot of jokes made about, you know, the character being a tenor and all of that kind of stuff. And also it was interesting when we did Lullaby of Broadway, and Gower was so, he was a genius. He was another genius. And when he was staging Lullaby of Broadway, he added the principles and it became a big production number. And as we all came in and we sort of like auditioned with the solos, well, it was a joke because I actually ended up being the first voice, you know, because I said, oh, good, it's Leroy again. So, you know, we got a big laugh out of that. But then because they kept upping the keys and everything, when we got to one point of the number, when Jerry was supposed to sing, let's call it a day, to come out with a big thing, of course, got the note. And of course, Jerry's supposed to, and Jerry said, I can't hit that note. And so when we did rehearsal, let's call it, and just looked at me and gave a hand, and I hit the note. And, of course, everybody laughed, and they left it in. And Jerry Orbach was one of the great people of the theater, too. What a wonderful, steady, grounded foundation of any show. Everybody loved Jerry. And he was not at all selfish. If it was for the show, he was all for it. And so that became a lovely moment in the show that, you know, I got to hit the note. And also was a laugh. So, you know, Jerry was never insecure that way.
Well, it was an incredible cast. He and you and, of course, Tammy Grimes and Joe Bova and Carol Cook.
Yes, yes. We had a wonderful time with the show, and I did it for almost 8 years.
When Gower Champion and Michael Stewart and Mark Bramble and David Merrick came to do the show, I think they did such a wonderful job of making it into a Broadway musical, to the extent where you think, how could this not have been a Broadway musical to begin with?
It's a movie about a Broadway show, so that, you know, was to its credit. But right. Michael Stewart and Mark did a lovely job of transferring the film into a Broadway show. They really did a lovely job making, and of course those great numbers. So that's what the evening was all about. And Gower had such a cinematic attitude when he directed that all of his shows, like Hello, Dolly and everything, you never see weight in the show. You see the sets moving. He choreographed the sets. All the transitions were very cinematic, fade into this, fade out to that, taking a number and then having it build to another portion of the plot, and all done, you know, in a sequence. And Gower was brilliant at doing that, and he doesn't get enough credit for what he did with the theater. He was great at directing shows. He can make them move and stage them better than anybody. And he doesn't get the credit he deserves. So I'm a big fan of Gower Champions.
Well, that was an amazing show. We're going to thank you so much for joining us. And we're going to end with one of my favorite moments from the cast album, which is Leroy featured in the song Dames. The whole album is so fantastic. The orchestrations, the performances, everything. But it is one of my favorite moments. So we'll end with that. And thanks so much for being with us again, Leroy.
It's always an absolute pleasure, Michael. I enjoyed it, and I'm so happy that the people who are listening hopefully will enjoy it too, so that we can preserve what we do better than anybody, and that's the musical theater.
Absolutely. Talk to you soon, Leroy.
Okay, Michael. Bye bye.
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 What do you go for? Go see a show for. Tell the truth, you go to see those beautiful days. You spend your low for. Who pays the room for? All those cute and darling, young and beautiful days.
Okay, well, it was great to speak with Leroy Reams, as always. He's such a wonderful guest with so many great stories. And now I'd like to introduce Matt Koplik, my cohort, who will hopefully be joining us very often on these podcasts. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Michael.
Matt is the creator and host of Baking It on Broadway. That's B-A-K-I-N-G. It on Broadway, a popular web series in which Broadway actors discuss the inner workings of Broadway shows all while baking a dessert. It's really great. You have to check it out. We'll put a link in the show notes. And Matt holds a BFA in musical theater from Emerson College and is a member of Actors Equity Association. And he would just like everyone to know that his Playbill collection is legendary.
It is at that.
Now, Matt, I wanted to start off by saying what I got in the mail today was a little package from School of Rock. Actually, not a little package, quite a big package. What happens is that a lot of the shows send various materials out to voters for the various awards, and I'm a Drama Desk voter, so I guess that's why I got it. And this package includes a program and some other things, but also includes a vinyl 2LP recording of the cast album, which I just got in the mail today. As I say, just got it, so I haven't even had a chance to listen to it. And plus, I don't have a turntable, so
most people don't these days. I feel like it's more of a for decoration these days than for anything else.
Well, actually, I wanted to ask you about that because as you are very much a creature of the digital age. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about this? It's really quite amazing, this whole throwback to vinyl. They're republishing, reprinting lots of classic albums on vinyl, not just show albums, but classic rock albums, etc. Is that anything you've gotten into at all, and how do you feel about it?
I haven't really gotten into it in terms of purchasing vinyls of more recent works, only because, as you know, you said yourself, I don't have a turntable as well, so there's not much I can really do with it. I do collect a couple of vinyls of, you know, cast albums, stuff like, you know, On a Clear Day You Can See Forever, Hello Dolly, stuff like that. But I kind of keep them more as, I guess, souvenirs, I guess, almost, which sounds really weird. But it's sort of, I like the feel of them. I like the look of them. If I had a turntable, I would play them, and I hope to get one soon. I just can't really find any other way to get them other than eBay. But I also have the School of Rock LP because that was gifted to me, and I was like, fantastic. I can't use it, but I very much enjoy holding on to it.
Well, they're, you know, I mean, they're really, every store you go into, there are all these turntables for sale in all kinds of stores. And as you probably know, there are even, I believe, turntables that you can hook up right up to your computer. And
sure they got all the things these days. I'm sure that's also true.
Yeah, I think they have USB ports and things like that. So it's really, I myself have not gotten back into vinyl. And honestly, I don't even know where I'd put a turntable, but I think I'm going to have to think about that.
Yeah, it seems like we're all going to start redecorating our homes for a turntable again.
Yes, absolutely. Assuming we have the space, which is a big if. But anyway, so there are a couple of new recordings I'd love to speak with Matt about that he mentioned he'd like to talk about. One is Bright Star. Maybe you could talk about that a little bit and maybe pick a track for us to play.
Sure. Bright Star is the Broadway musical written by Edie Brickell and Steve Martin. It's known right now for its bluegrass sound, which Steve Martin and Edie Brickell excel at. There's one track in particular that I really love called Whoa Mama, and it's sort of the, I don't want to say meet cute, but it's the song that sort of sparks the romantic central relationship of the show between Carmen Cusack and Paul Alexander Nolan. And it is very old school in the sense that it sort of harks back to the Rodgers and Hammerstein, you know, conditional love song. It's two people who are very into each other, and one of them is sort of not willing to admit it just yet. And I love that idea of the song. I have a couple of issues with Bright Star, the score, mostly just lyric-wise. I find that the lyrics are not as up to snuff as the music or the orchestrations is, but this is one song where I actually feel like the lyrics are pretty strong. In fact, I think all the songs that those two characters sing together throughout the show are definitely the strongest lyrically. That, I Had a Vision, and What Could Be Better, all three songs I think are very strong songs and probably the three strongest in the score.
Yes, I would definitely agree with you on that about the lyrics not being quite as good as the music, but there are really some wonderful moments in the show, and we had Carmen Cusack as our guest on our other podcast, our This Week on Broadway podcast recently. She was delightful. Everyone loves her in the show, deservedly so.
She's absolutely amazing in the show. She does a stellar job, and she's stellar on the recording too. yeah, they make the wise decision to have her sort of front and center a lot in the show because she really is amazing.
Yes, and Paul Alexander Nolan has really been doing some great work in several shows recently. I first became aware of him in the last revival of Jesus Christ Superstar. Yes. But then he went into – he was a replacement in Once. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, he was in
Dr. Zhivago.
And then off-Broadway, he was in Daddy Long Legs. And he's really been working constantly. And I think it's easy to understand why. Because
I think he's exceptionally talented. I saw him in Jesus Christ Superstar as well. And I really was very struck by his Jesus in that. I went into that revival with not very high expectations. I had done the show. I had seen the movie. I know the show pretty backwards and forwards. And it's a show I enjoy but don't really love. And I was really taken with that production. And him especially, I thought he was one of the best sung Jesuses I've ever heard. All the notes were there and very healthy, but still had that nice sort of rock sound to it. Very thrilling, I found. And so I've been listening to him pretty much ever since.
Absolutely. So with that, let's listen to Carmen Cusack and Paul Alexander Nolan from Bright Star.
Someone will take your hand just like so. Someone will never want to let you go. Someone will put you on a pedestal. Someone will tell you you're incredible.
I'm a young girl and I want to go dancing. Want to dip at 12 with the handsomest boy in town. Somebody better comb their hair and put a clean shirt on. Pick me up at 8. Somebody better take me there. Gonna have a lot of fun on my very first date. Someone will walk for you to walk her home. Someone will want a little time alone. Someone will wait as long as it takes for you.
Next up, The Color Purple. I know that both Matt and I are very enamored of the current Broadway revival and the recording. So what would you like to listen to from that, Matt?
Oh, God.
I know it's hard to pick.
How much time do we have? Can we just go start to finish? I really can't think of one. The obvious answer would be I'm Here. That's Cynthia Erivo pretty much giving the best performance of a musical number this season. It's sort of like a Christine Ebersole and, Grey Gardens level, but I'm going to go a little different. I'm still going to go with Cynthia, but I would like to do her, Jennifer Hudson doing a different kind of love song, a very quiet love song, called What About Love, on the nose title, but it's, a song that when I first heard it in the original, cast album with the very talented LaShawns and Felicia P. Fields, I found that it was a little too pop-ish for me, and I felt that I was taken out of the moment because it felt a little too grand. They're both very talented vocalists, and they were really wailing in that number. And then when I saw this revival, it was a very quiet number with Jennifer Hudson and Cynthia Erivo, who we both know are, incredible vocalists and could really go to town on that number if they chose to, but they had showed a lot of restraint, and I found that very dramatically compelling. It was a very nuanced take on the sort of discovery of love.
Yes, I think there's sort of general agreement that the original production of The Color Purple, although it had many wonderful things about it, was a little overproduced and a little too big and a little too loud, maybe.
In their defense, it was sort of right at the end of new musicals going for like Big or Broke. And I think they definitely took a cue from the movie, which being directed by Steven Spielberg was very grand. But it's an intimate story. And I felt that John Doyle really kind of took what worked about the original production and added elements that he thought were missing and made it a whole new experience out of it.
Oh, absolutely. Then that's a really, really interesting point. But on the other hand, I would say there are still some shows that are overproduced and some that aren't. And it's hard. And it's hard not to, I think, on Broadway nowadays, because the, you know, so many people seem to feel that everyone wants a lot of bang for their buck and everything's got to be really big and loud. But as you say, The Color Purple is really a wonderful character study and basically an intimate show in many respects.
Absolutely.
So let's, with that, listen to Cynthia Erivo and Jennifer Hudson in What About Love from The Color Purple.
What about tenderness?
Tenderness.
What about tears when I'm happy? What about wings when I fall? I want you to a story for me that I can believe in forever. So what about love? Will you be my light in the storm?
What about hope?
What about joy?
What about joy?
What about tears when I'm happy?
Okay, so that was The Color Purple. That was really great. I got an advanced copy of the cast album of the Encores 2015 production of Paint Your Wagon, which I'm very excited about. Depending on when this podcast is posted and when you listen to it, you may be getting a preview because it's not officially released until May 27th. So, Matt, did you get to see Paint Your Wagon at Encores?
I did. I loved Paint Your Wagon at Encores. I thought it was like the perfect Encore show. It was a musical with a score that was just so incredible and really well presented. With a book that's, you know, slightly problematic, that kind of keeps it from being produced these days, but it really kind of was a very respectful, energized presentation. And I know that this cast album was set in motion for a long time, so I'm thrilled that it's coming out finally.
Yeah, I mean, I got it sent to me so recently that I have not had a chance to listen to it, but I can't wait. I'm going to probably listen to it tonight. I agree about the book and it being a perfect show for Encores in that respect. There's some things in the book that have not dated that well. Some things about bigamy and things of that sort. But the score is absolutely phenomenal. Lerner and Lowe, their first big hit. And Brigadoon, right?
Yeah, I think Brigadoon was the first. This was the show at post Brigadoon, maybe, I think.
Yes. Brigadoon was 47, I believe, and Paint Your Wagon is 1951. The Encores production was great, and one of the best things about this recording is that it's really the first modern modern stereo recording of the score, because the original was 1951, and it's not a bad recording, but in those days, again, they couldn't fit that much on an LP, and everything was in mono, and so it's not complete, and it doesn't show off the score to its best advantage. But here we have state-of-the-art sound and a really great cast in doing Paint Your Wagon. We have
there's Keith Carradine,
Justin Guarini, and Alexandra Socha in the leads.
Yeah, they're all great.
Yeah, but the track I would like to play is They Call the Wind Mariah, which featured this unbelievably incredible singer named Nathaniel Hackman, who really, as far as I know, he just sort of came out of nowhere. And his character in the show is not a lead. It's just the person who gets to sing They Call the Wind Mariah, which is really an amazing, amazing, beautiful song with the male chorus. So thank you, Matt, for being with us. I hope you join us again soon.
I hope you do. Well, thank you.
We will leave our listeners with this amazing recording of Nathaniel Hackman singing They Call the Wind Mariah from the 2015 Encores cast recording of Paint Your Wagon.
Even God can find me. Ooh.